Hello, my name is David Lankus. I'm a professor here at Syracuse University's iSchool, and I want to thank you so much for having me. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. I hope someday to get over there. But once again, thanks for the opportunity. Today, I want to talk about opportunities. Today, I want to talk about opportunities and challenges and the relationship. A lot of talk is going on about what is the future of libraries, talking about threats, talking about opportunities, talking about all of these things. What I'd like to spend some time on is how we can turn challenges into opportunities by changing fundamentally what we think of libraries. Now, I say changing fundamentally what we think of libraries, and a lot of my talk has been labeled as new librarianship. But really, it's old librarianship. It's going back to the fundamentals of why we created this profession, why we created libraries, and why we do what it is that we do. So, what I want to talk about is how we could use fundamental understandings and our history to change and preserve and enhance our opportunities in the future. Now, I'm going to start in a sort of odd place, and I'm going to start with this gentleman. I'm going to start with Nietzsche. And this is a quote we use all the time: that which does not kill us makes us stronger. And it's a very exciting quote. And if that is in fact the case, libraries should be a pretty strong set of institutions. We've been talking about the death of libraries for, I think, ever since we had libraries. Whether it was people invading and burning them down, whether it was anti-intellectualism, whether it was totalitarianism, whether it was new technologies, whatever it's been, we've been talking about the collapse of libraries for a long time. And so, we've gotten stronger, I would argue, over time. We've gotten stronger in both what we do it, but also within our positions within communities. Now, clearly, we're in a time where those challenges are coming up again, when we're questioning what those opportunities are and we're questioning those challenges. We're, in essence, being asked to reassert our fitness, to think about why is it that we need libraries. And far from that questioning be a negative thing, far from that questioning being a reason to give up, that questioning, I believe, can make us stronger. So let's talk about some of those challenges. Let's talk about some of those things that are trying to kill us, but I think will make us stronger. So we'll start with the traditional predictions of doom. They go everything from a blog post that came out 2 days ago about why we need libraries to when the Google first came out to when the internet first came out to frankly when microfiche and the radio and television came about. Right, we weren't supposed to need schools anymore because we could do it all via TV, or we didn't need the symphonies anymore because we could listen to it on telephones. What we found is that these challenges, a lot of them technological, but many of them sociological, many of them about the changes in culture and people, they've always been times for us to look and say, what are we doing? Should we continue to do it? So I want to just pick on three of what I consider the sort of most popular reasons that libraries are going away. The first, I want to talk about the cost and quality of publishing and how that affects both academic and school and public libraries and special libraries and government libraries. Then I want to talk about the digital death of documents, not the death of digital documents, but how digital and the idea that we're putting these things online are supposed to destroy our concepts of documents. And doesn't that fundamentally destroy the concept of libraries and organizing and keeping and providing access to documents? And lastly, and this is the one that we keep hearing, it's all on the net. The idea that we're going to get rid of libraries because the internet has provided such access. We have access on our phones, we have access at home. And while not every region of the world, and I apologize for a very US-centric view of things, is at the same level of access, we sort of see it as this coming trend that there are more cell phones in the world than there are toilets in the world. Clearly, we're moving to a point where access will be ubiquitous. And what does that mean for libraries, which have really created themselves and formed themselves out of a world of information scarcity? How do we take an organization that was built around providing access to information when access was difficult and keep it relevant when access becomes considerably easier? So let's start with the first one. Let's talk about the cost and quality of publishing. Now, once again, I'm in doom talk here, so my job is to get you scared. And just hold on because it gets better. But we have to talk about that there are some significant changes going on right now to the world of information and document production, of publishing of books and journals and materials that are fundamentally challenging why we have libraries, how libraries work, whether they're sustainable, etc. And the first one I think we've all encountered is moving from purchase to license. That, in fact, the most used resources that we have in our libraries are the things that we don't own. There was a time when we owned everything, when we bought the documents and we put them on shelves or we put them in files or we bought them on microfiche, and we owned them. And people would come in and we would collectively get money, tuition dollars, tax dollars, government dollars, what have you, and we would buy these very expensive things. We would own them and we would keep them. And so people could come in and use them, and years and years and decades and centuries, those materials would be ours to house, protect, and disseminate. But we know in a digital world, that's not what's happening. That as the markets, as the information producers and publishers and commercial organizations have gone online, they didn't simply shift the format of the materials. They didn't simply take a book and make it an electronic book. They didn't simply take a journal and make it an electronic journal. They changed how the business model works. They used it as an opportunity to get out of the ownership model. So what we see is that instead of buying a book or a database or materials or maps, we are now licensing those materials. We are paying not a one-time fee to have it forever, but we're paying a continuous cost, where every year it's going to cost us money to continue access to that material. And if we ever stop paying, there goes the access to the materials. We've, in essence, lost our first sale doctrine. We've lost the ability to say we own it and we can circulate it, we can archive it, we can cut it up, we can digitize it, we can do whatever because we own it. We've given that up to say we're just buying access. And if you look at your budget and you look at where you're spending a majority of your amounts of time and dollars and effort and et cetera, it's increasingly moving away from the things that we own to things that we license. We're spending a huge amount of our time worrying about things that aren't ours. So we're paying twice. We're paying for access, and then we're paying for caretaking of someone else's materials. And we see that publishers are also using this as an opportunity to bypass archives, to bypass universities, to bypass libraries in general, and go direct consumers. We're seeing large corporations that will license these databases without any library. We're seeing the idea that you can buy individual access to academic journals and documents and encyclopedias. And so we're seeing this, that publishers not only see it as a chance to get continuous income, to get out of losing property to libraries, but now they can bypass them and go directly to consumers. That's problematic. The other issue that often comes up around this idea of the quality of publishing is around self-publishing. That what we're seeing is not only traditional publishers that have been publishing books and journals for a long time moving to an electronic format, moving to a world where they're providing the information and can continue to charge it, we're moving to where everyone's a publisher. We're losing our traditional markers of quality. Where we used to say, oh, that's a great publisher, get all these books, get these materials. When we used to say, just because it's gone through the publishing process, we assume it's gone through peer review, we assume it's gone through editorial work, we assume that there's been a lot of effort to make sure this is a quality product, we're now getting people with a click of the mouse can publish their manifesto and make it look like a beautiful book with a beautiful cover, even though the internal contents are of questionable quality. Right? And we also get the idea that these folks who are now self-publishing, and by the way, I'm one of them, that these self-publishers are often ignorant of the library market. I hope that's not me, but you get my point. That when someone puts out a book and they put it through CreateSpace or Lulu.com or one of these self-publishing things, they have no idea that traditionally libraries have bought them at bulk, bought them at different pricing, that this is a way to get into academia. This is a way that people are going to look at it. And so we're getting this sort of digital bypass, this idea that we can produce things direct to the world. And let the world figure out how to get it, how to organize it, how to use it. We're also looking at what I call the digital death of documents. And that's where we have to understand that ebooks are fundamentally different thing than books. Right? So we've been talking a lot about how public libraries, for example, can get the latest and greatest materials now that they're in ebook format. And how do we get them, acquire them, circulate them? And what we've been trying to do, and what publishers have been trying to do, is to squeeze this digital genie, this new format, this new thought, into a traditional thing. To try and, in essence, make it like a book. But it's not. We see that, for example, in too many formats and too little interoperability. The idea that you could pull a book off the shelf and say, I'm sorry, you aren't qualified to use it. You don't have the right software in your brain is crazy. And yet that's where we are. Do you have a Kindle? Do you have a Nook? Do you have Apple? Do you have this? Do you have that? Oh, you can only read this with the PDF reader. Oh, it doesn't include this document restrictions, this digital rights management side. So this is a whole new thing. And we're going to see in a moment how fundamentally different it is. But we're also seeing the move away from the idea of a book to an app. That what happens is instead of taking our intellectual content and providing it in a relatively universal format, paper that we can learn how to flip pages, we're making digital documents which are fundamentally linked to the marketplace and technologies of their creation and dissemination. And these are walled gardens. Amazon wants to get the Kindle world out there not so that they can make it easy for people, but because they can make it the only option for people. The only way you can get this content or this app is if you run Android or you run Apple's iOS 7 or you run this platform or that platform. And so we have this situation where the markets are trying not to build interoperability, not trying to build a market that's easy for institutions like libraries and individuals to cross over boundaries. We have a marketplace, a commercial marketplace, that is driven to exclusivity, where the idea is to make it the only way that you can get the materials is through this. And that's a walled garden approach. But it's more difficult than that. It's worse than that. The idea of what is a document itself is dissolving. Think about how much library operations, how much library thinking, structures, building, facilities, management, training, teaching is built around the document-like object. When you're working with a student to try and find a good resource, do you talk about things like peer reviews and journals versus magazines versus books versus et cetera, newspapers? We love this idea that there's this thing that we can hold on to, that while it may not have traditional binding and stitching and covers, it has the equivalent of electronic versions of those. Yet we're now working with many things that don't fit that. How do you create a mark or an RDA record for Facebook? How does Google get cataloged? And I don't mean the things you find through Google. I mean the service itself. We run into things like gigapixel images. That is, even things that might look like traditional documents are so different in a digital environment that it dissolves. A gigapixel image, and I'm going to show you an example in a second. A gigapixel image is an image that has such massive amounts of data and resolution in it that you can zoom in across miles and still see faces. Hold that thought for a second. So we're seeing this dissolving of a document into linked chaos. What do I mean? Well, let's start with a document and I'll show you. So we know that these days electronic documents on the web, for example, aren't simply documents. They're actually links between text and an image. But let's say that text begins to change and shift. What's to prevent us from coming up with new editions every day, every morning? I wrote books. I would love to be able to go into my book and say, oh, there's a typo. Let me add a comma. Let me add a change. But what's to prevent if I have that capability, because it's a digital document, for me to go in and say, oh, I got that wrong. I'm going to totally change it. So now when people come and say, see, you got it wrong, I can say, no, I changed it. And remember those gigapixel images, this link to an image, which it used to say, well, that's what an image is. And we can describe it. For example, here's the city of Tokyo. How hard is it to say, here's a cityscape of Tokyo? But what if I said that this image is so high resolution that I can look at the license plates of the cars in this image? And you're saying, what cars? What license plates? Where are they? And I say, how about this car? And you go, what do you mean that car? And with a gigapixel image, with one image, I can zoom all the way down to that circle to say this car. Now this car, I can see its license plate. If you were standing next to it, I could see your face. And remember, I'm taking this image from miles away. Did you know I was taking that image? Did you know I could know where you are at what point? If you're going to describe this, does this mean you have to catalog every car in it? And you say, well, Dave, come on. You can do that with lots of different images. But we're talking about being able to go to France, take a picture of the Notre Dame, and say, here's an image of the Notre Dame. But then have a scholar go in who's doing work on the gargoyles, the architecture and the history and the art of gargoyles. And they can zoom into that picture and see every individual sculpture, every individual face. Is that one image? Is that hundreds of images? Is that thousands of images? How does that work? And we know these days it's not just a matter of images and text. Increasingly, we're including functions, software, code in these pages as well. So if I'm going to teach you about accounting, I cannot simply say, I can say, here's the formula, here's what the formula does. I can put an actual piece of code in there so you can enter your own data and get the answers back. How do you organize that? How do you catalog that? How do you capture that at any given time? And what's worse is we know that all of these things are probably sitting in multiple servers on multiple places, and increasingly on the cloud. On the cloud where we don't even know who the server is. We have situations where services will go out. They'll just like Netflix won't work today. Facebook won't work today. Why? Because there was an electrical outage in Washington, D.C. of the United States that took out Amazon's part of Amazon's grid. You didn't even know you were using Amazon before it. By the way, enter into the idea of surveillance and where that data sits and who can look at it and why they can look at it, and it gets really complicated. And even now, I'm giving you a relatively simple idea of how this image can be broken down because I'm pretending that I'm the author of it. But why not have hundreds of authors of a document? There's a group called IFBook that's looking at the future of the book. And what they're talking about is not the wiki idea, so go in, create a page, everyone can edit it. But they can actually talk about writing a book. So my next book, rather than writing it, editing, go through a publisher, print it out, send it out, I can put it up as I'm writing and other people can correct and add and annotate and change. And where is that? How do you organize that? If I'm looking for an annotation, how does that annotation become the primary document and not secondary to this other thing? How does that happen? How do we keep up track? So what we even do in terms of organizing and collecting and disseminating documents is dissolving to the point where there is no document. One person, when they were talking about new librarianship, which we'll get into in a second, they said, "Dave, you seem to be proposing a sort of post-library librarianism," which is fair, but really I'm trying to propose a post-document library. What does a library look like when our concept of a document gets totally blown away? By the way, little preview for where we're going with this is not the first time it's happened. Right? At some point, we changed from tablets to scrolls and scrolls to manuscripts and manuscripts to printed and etc. But the idea is we're challenged again to rethink it, and it's going to reshape how we think about a library. Now, the other one that's always out there is it's all on the net. This is just an infographic showing the massive users and the growth of users online. And the idea that people can get access to this from their computer, increasingly in a mobile environment, wherever they are, working on through your glasses, etc. And once we can get to all these digital documents and be online, why do I need a library? Where is it? How does that fit in? If I can get to it through Google, or I can get to it through Amazon, or I can get through anywhere, what do I need a library for? Now, this is an argument which, once again, previewing is very much about people who already have access and can afford it. But let's just give it the benefit of the doubt. When people can access things online easier than going a place, how does that change our libraries? So we also have related to it's all on the net is the idea of people will take good enough. How do we face the fact that the world is full of good enough information? That yes, you may have a better document or a better resource hidden in your library, on the stacks, in the databases, somewhere. But if people find it on Google, that's good enough. People just grab the information that's good enough, and they don't worry about is it better, is there a new version of that. They simply take what's available to them. How do we deal with that? And I want to stop us right here, because I want to start twisting around these assumptions. And this one's a really easy one to twist around, because I've seen this in public areas, where public librarians complain that people will get it off of Google and not the better resource. I've certainly seen it in school libraries, where school libraries complain all the time that students are willing to copy and paste from the net, and they don't spend the time worrying about what's quality, where did it come from, who's the author. And in academic libraries, it's practically religion, where we talk about undergraduates and new students who come in and they simply want good enough. They'll take whatever. If you hand them an abstract and a title, that's what they'll cite as opposed to actually reading the article. They're lazy. They don't get up and look online. We created a world of lazy lookers, of people who simply go and grab whatever's at hand, and that's good enough. But what's interesting is that good enough has a bit of a scientific basis. And if you look at the scientific basis of good enough, we're getting it wrong. Good enough comes from this idea of satisficing. It's a weird world, right? From satisfaction, satisficing. And it's from Herb Simon, won a Nobel Prize talking about this in economics. And what Herb Simon was trying to do is he was trying to look at economics and he was trying to look at organizations. And the traditional view of organizations, the traditional way of handling how organizations work is around the concept of optimization. That companies want to do whatever they do in the most efficient way possible. They want to exert the least amount of effort to get the most gain. And any logical organization, any rational organization, when they approach a market, when they approach a problem, when they build a system, seek to optimize. And Herb Simon went to look at how people are optimizing, because the assumption that most people were making up to this point was that organizations, as they optimize systems, and not just technical systems, but all systems, were doing it in what's called a perfect world, in a perfect information environment. In essence, they knew all the variables of which they could play. They knew the cost of things, and they knew what the cost of things were going to be the day after, and the day after, and the day after. They knew personnel. They knew their opponents. They knew all of this stuff. And what Herb Simon said is, that's not how the world works. If you're going against a competitor is not going to share with you their costing, their pricing, their strategy. And so they're going to change the environment as you go ahead. In global markets, we can't tell what oil is going to cost a transportation company more than a couple of hours ahead. Days and weeks, this idea that somehow we can optimize our use of the oil resource when we don't know what the cost is going to be is crazy. And so Herb Simon said, how are people doing this? And what he found out is that people are satisficing, that people are making good enough decisions. But good enough is not lazy decisions. Good enough is not the easy decisions. Good enough is the idea of the best decisions given the information available. So if we look, for example, at a simple chart that looks at cost versus effect, in other words, how much resources do I have to put in play to get what effect? How many books do I have to buy to make my community happy with my collection? How many librarians do I need to staff to handle the workload? Right? Take a simple question like that. How many librarians need to be at the desk next Thursday? How do you know? Well, you say, oh, I just look at the past Thursdays, and we've always had this number of people. And we only have this many people that we could deploy anyway, and these people are doing it. Right? So you're working all the variables out. And you come up and say, all right, so I can get a high effect, a high service, if I put the minimum number of librarians on the desk. That's a logical decision. The problem comes in that next Thursday there's a massive event that the mayor is putting on, that the principal's putting on, that the provost is putting on, and it's at the library and you didn't know about it, and suddenly your costs skyrocket because you got to bring in people for overtime and all this other stuff. What Herb Simon said is, satisficing, good enough, is when we make a decision based on imperfect information. We will exert the least amount of effort to get the most amount of effect, right? You do it all the time, right? When you think about, what am I going to, you know, I'm doing a book report. I have to get this data. I have to do whatever. In your mind, you're sitting there going, all right, how much time do I have? What's in front of me? What can I get to quickly? Boom. People use Google not because they're lazy, but because it gives them a relatively high effect for a very low cost. Students will cite Google because if they get an A on the paper, they're pretty sure they're going to get an A on the next paper. But if we do things like, if you cite, you can only cite journal articles, you can only cite things from peer-reviewed sources, what we do is we change the nature of the effect. And now they have to say, oh, well, if I want an A, I've got to spend more time looking in different resources, et cetera, et cetera. Good enough means that's optimized. That's what we're trying to get at. Now, behind all of these doomsday scenarios, behind all of these things that are talking about how libraries are going to go out of business because it's all on the net, because documents are dissolving, because the cost in publishing is changing, is a single massive assumption. If you look at those things that I just went through, if you look at the change in publishing and the cost of publishing, you look at documents going away, and you look at the increased availability of information, easily available information on the web, and you say, that's it, libraries are done, time to retire, thanks for coming, you've made a massive assumption. That massive assumption is that libraries equal books, equal documents. You've built the assumption around a mission of libraries that looks like the mission of a library is to collect, organize, and provide access to information. If I got up and started this, if I started library school, if I started a speech to consulting groups, et cetera, and I said, all right, the mission of your library is to collect, organize, and provide access to that information, my guess is most of you would go, yeah, all right, I might quibble a little bit, I might change a little, I might want to throw a user in there somewhere, but yeah, I'm good with that. My question to you when you look at that mission is to ask the question, why? That mission, libraries to collect, organize, and provide access to information, misses why. Why do we collect information? Why do we organize information? Why do we provide access to those things? I mean, and why those three together? If I collect information, there are lots of people who collect information. They gather it and they keep it up close and they hold it. They collect things, they collect books, they collect rare manuscripts, they collect paintings. They don't worry about organizing, disseminating, they just want the stuff. What about organize? There are plenty of places that collect stuff, provide access to it, but it's there. Good luck, sort through it. And there are plenty of people who provide access, like Google. Google provides access, but they actually don't collect a bunch of it. They simply provide lots of pointers. Why do we do each one of those, and why do we put them together? I would argue that there's that next underlying assumption, that one, the documents are why we're here, because all of those things, collect, organize, and provide access to information, really translates into documents these days. But I think the answer to why we do that is something so fundamental we don't even question it. In other words, if I say it again, you're going to go, yeah, of course, which is so people can learn and they can improve society, right? We have libraries. All types of libraries, to make people better, to make them more knowledgeable, to help them make better decisions. Whatever word you want to put in there, the collecting, organizing, providing access to information simply comes from an attempt to make them better. And those are the tools and functions that have grown up over time to fulfill that larger mission. And that mission, to me, is very fundamental to the mission of a librarian. And what is that mission? The mission of a librarian is to improve society. By the way, you're welcome to stop there. Your job is to make society better through facilitating knowledge creation within communities. Get rid of this word information. It's not helpful. Think about for a moment, what is your definition of information? I'll wait. Okay. My guess is some of you said data. Yeah, it's stuff. It's ones and zeros and data. Some of you said, oh, no. I remember this. I've learned the data, information, knowledge, wisdom hierarchy. Data is just measurements. Information is with context. Knowledge is when you can understand it in relation to your world, and wisdom is when you can put it into action. Lovely. Context. Where does that come from? It breaks down because all of this comes from how people interpret it. What is information to me may not be information to you. For example, I'm giving this talk in English. Some people don't speak English, my guess is. Ugly American, sorry. How much information's in this presentation until it's translated? Right? Not a lot. How about if I hand you a book? I wrote the book. I hand you the book. Does it have more information to you or more information to me? I wrote it, so it's really duplicative of what I know. Not a lot of new information is going to come out of that book. But to you, it may be a lot. Or, frankly, you may look at it and say, this is garbage, and you may get nothing out of it. This is idea around information and being information-oriented. It's not helpful. Now, knowledge. Knowledge is a different thing. Knowledge is what's in our head and how we understand the world. So let's break this mission down a little bit. First of all, notice that it's a mission of librarians. It's about people, not institutions. Now, we've been trained in the library profession, and we've been trained in most of society, to think of institutions first. For example, have you done a press release or report in the past year where you talked about the library doing something? The library hosted this event. The library circulated this many books. The library provided this database. Libraries don't do anything. If they're buildings, all they do is decay and exert gravity. Librarians, staff, the people in it do those things. They made the decision. One of the things that drives me crazy about our profession is we hide behind the building, we hide behind the stacks. We say, oh, the building did it, the library did it, the organization did it. We did it. If your library website sucks, it's your fault. You put it up. You're responsible for it. So we have to get away from this idea that the library does anything. It's librarians that do it, and put ourselves a little bit forward. Give ourselves a little bit more credit, and frankly, a little bit more risk in exposing the individuals who do it. And we're here to create knowledge. Now we go back to that. What is knowledge? What is information? Dave, you just said information doesn't matter. What's knowledge? Knowledge is what's here. It's uniquely human. Knowledge is what allows us to interact with the world. When we encounter a situation, new or old, knowledge is how we react to that situation. What do we do within it? What skills do we bring to it? What understandings do we bring to it? And how do we create knowledge? It's not by typing. It's not buying it. You can't put knowledge on a shelf. This idea that you have knowledge containers is garbage. The closest thing to a knowledge container is the human skull. Knowledge is uniquely human. And how do we build it? How do we create it? We create it through conversations. And conversations, what do you mean, Dave? I read and I create knowledge. I'm not talking to the book. No, you're not. I'm not talking to the author. That author may be dead. You're right. So who am I talking to? Yourself. And if you just sat there and said, what did he mean I'm talking to myself? Who were you asking that question? We have lots of internal conversations, but we also talk with teachers, we talk with colleagues, we talk with friends, we talk with bosses, we talk with the public. This conversation is how we build knowledge. And what we're going to talk about in a moment is if that's our mission, not collecting and organizing and providing access to, but creating knowledge, we have to be in the conversation business. We have to talk about providing access to conversations, how we organize conversations, how we collect conversations. Once again, that may turn into materials that we can read and artifacts, but it may be services, it may be whole new things. We're going to talk about those in a second. Because the other thing is, we talk about to improve society. Well, that's a big, tall order. Now, my guess is you have this, you own this, you think about this. You say the world is better because libraries are here. That's why you chose this profession. That's why you came to this conference, is because you believe you can make a difference. But think about that and then throw it up against that classic librarians are non-biased. That one of our values is that we are unbiased, that we provide even and balanced information. There is no such thing as unbiased. If you're in the knowledge game, if you're in providing knowledge, if you're in a human learning, human interaction world, you are full of biases. Now, we like to talk about the biases of political ideology or the biases of race or the biases of religion. We're pretty good at balancing those. We're pretty good at being intellectually honest to talk about multiple perspectives. But we're still full of biases. If when you're asked a question, you go to type or you go to reach for a book, you've shown a bias. If you choose to start a conversation in English or Russian or French, you've shown a bias. By simply walking up and talking to someone who's tall or small or fat, you've shown a bias. It's natural. As human beings, as we learn to work our way through the world, we make assumptions, we make resolutions, we make ways of interacting with the world. When you woke up this morning and you went to this conference and you walked or you took a bike or you drove, you assumed that you could walk there, that you could drive there, that your bike would work. That's a bias. We live it all the time. So we have to have an image of what improved society is, and librarians do have an image of what improved society means. A better society is a more knowledgeable society, a more literate society, a society that talks and engages in intellectual academic worlds. And there are parts of how we improve society we don't touch. Some of us, we don't worry about things like homelessness or feeding people Right? We spend time where that may encounter it, but we're going to deal with it so we can get them informed, so we can get them knowledgeable. So as a librarian, you are biased. You're biased by your values. To provide access to more and richer information is better. To allow intellectual safety and preservation of privacy is a bias. And they're good and they're important, but they're a bias nonetheless. And how do we do it? Well, we're going to talk about that in a second, but let me just give you a quick skim. We do that by providing access. But remember, not access just to materials and artifacts and databases and buildings, but to people and conversations and ideas and thoughts, regardless of their format, regardless of whether they're in a document-like object. We provide training and knowledge. In other words, when people come and say, I need to get on the internet, we'll teach them how to get on the internet. We'll teach them how to get to the conversation. After the Arab Spring occurred in Egypt, the first one, there was a revolution and Mubarak stepped down and people were trying to figure out, you know, live their life. The Library of Alexandria suddenly saw this massive surge of grandmothers and taxi drivers coming into the library that never had before. Why? Because they'd heard about Facebook and social media from the revolution and they wanted to see what was there. They couldn't be part of the conversation unless they knew how to use this technology, so we provide that training. And an environment where they feel safe. And finally, we understand why they're coming to us and how we can motivate them. So let's go with this new idea back to our predictions of doom. Cost and quality of publishing will put libraries out of business because we're into basically the consumption of publishing world. Let's think about that for a minute. If we're really in the knowledge business and we're really in the conversation business, what the publishers do may affect part of what we do, access to these archives and output of a certain type of conversation. But really, there are conversations going on throughout our community. If we look at ourselves as publishers of the community, suddenly that's an opportunity for us. This self-publishing idea, this idea that publishing doesn't even have to happen in a document, it can happen in video and music and experience, that gets really exciting. We'll go to that in a second. This idea that documents are dissolving and falling apart, that's fabulous because we really don't care. While we've been spending a lot of time and effort and functions around organizing documents, the truth is that we're in the conversation business, and so that's all right. Because guess what's not happening as we move to a digital world? Conversations are not stopping. People are not saying, I'm not talking anymore, right? They're exploding. They're talking to everyone. That means they need us more than ever. And it's all on the net? Yes. But not all people are on the net. Let's be honest. We have a necessary safety function, whether we're in academia or school or public or government or special libraries. So let's take this publisher of a community for a moment. Think for a moment about the idea that you have the catalog, right? So this is your library, and it's an integrated library system, right? It's a catalog, it's how you do the circulation, etc. And people come to the catalog, and through this, they find the material they want, right? A very simple idea, if you back to the book world, if you back to that assumption that libraries are document repositories, this is your view of libraries, right? You provide that middle section where you're providing access to and you're providing organization, right? All that's about access. And someone's coming in, they're getting that document. But we know already we're not stuck with documents. We've gone past that many, many years ago. We've gone past that 50, 60 years ago. We're providing access to music and movies and pictures and websites and databases and all these kinds of document-like objects. But let's go further. Let's go to the idea of instead of thinking about the library catalog, think of that as a platform. Think about that as an enabling platform where, yes, someone, some people, the community can come through that platform and they can find videos and books and materials and such. But they can also find other people, other interested parties. There is a discussion, we used to talk about the academic libraries, the heart of the campus. And someone once said, maybe these days we're more like the spleen of the campus. I think we're like the circulatory system of a campus. That when we get questions, we can go from professor to professor to professor, and as they're looking at documents and looking at materials, we can connect them in ways we never could before. When a school child comes into their school library doing a project, we can say, oh, you're interested in snakes? So is this person. Maybe you should work together. Suddenly, we can become a platform, both in our technology and us as librarians, in connecting people together. And those people we're connecting, that community, we keep saying, well, they're getting to each other and they're getting to our collections. But what about their own collections? Imagine a man came into the Ann Arbor District Library, a public library in the States, and he said, you know how I can go online and I can find a book in this library? I'm talking to Eli Nyberger, the associate director, and Eli said, yes. He said, you know how I can go to this system and I can find out if it's at this library or another branch library? Eli Nyberger said, yes. The man said, I got books at home I'm willing to share. Is there a reason they can't come to the library and find my stuff? If they want to check it out, I'll bring it the next day or within an hour and drop it off. Now, if you think of the library as a collection of documents that you own, that makes no sense. That's crazy. How would we catalog them? How would we, you know, index them and put them in plastic and put them on a shelf? But if you think of the library as a sharing platform where you're sharing, yes, your materials, but you're also sharing expertise and the community's expertise, it makes perfect sense. And what's more, it expands your collection. It expands the access and the conversations your community can have beyond your budget. And so suddenly this platform allows us to talk to groups and host groups and discuss it. We can do that in our physical meeting spaces. We can do it online with virtual discussions. But the idea is that we become this publisher of the community. That the expertise, if we're at an academic library, our professors can publish through us. And I don't mean just publish papers, but we can host their blog posts. We can record their lectures. We can provide information online. We can take these kinds of things and not lose them. The idea that somehow we get rid of the publisher and the idea that we are consumers and the publishers are producers, and we say that's garbage. Every librarian, every library, every member of our community both produces and consumes information. And while companies have been trying to force us into a consumption model of buying a video and buying a book and getting this and getting that, we can break it apart and talk about releasing the expertise of our community out to the world. When I want to come to Slovenia, if I want to come to your county, your city, whatever, and I go to your library, can I find out about your city? Can I find out about your institution from your library? Do you house and house the information of your community? Or do you only provide stuff for the community from other things? Are you a platform to allow for innovation? A platform to allow for sharing of expertise, conversations, materials, and knowledge? Or are you simply a repository that people can take from your very limited collection? Think about that for a minute. Now, this idea of conversations, not documents. Once again, we're not in the document business. You can say, but Dave, we're in the document business. A lot of people just want books from us. One, that's because that's what we say. That's what we advertise. That's how we broadcast ourselves. We need to teach our communities they should expect more of us. But the other thing is to look at a document and say, wait a minute, that document's not what you thought it is. So on the screen there is a rock. Yay, it's a rock. But what's interesting about this rock is it itself is sort of like a document. If you're an archaeologist, you can look at this book and you look at those scratches on the front, you realize that they're Native American drawings, icons, and you can understand the relevance of this to its culture. If you're a geologist, you can look at this rock and you can find out when it was formed and what its composition was and where it may have come from. I look at this rock, which happens to sit outside of a house in Arizona, and I think about a vacation I took with my wife where I took that picture. Now, what's interesting about that is the archaeology, the how it was made, the relevance to my life, none of that is in the rock. All of that is something we brought to the rock. That the archaeologist, that the anthropologist is having a conversation in which they mention the rock, that conversation goes on. And if we're focused on the conversation, facilitating it, making it happen, we house the rock, but how we organize it and find it should be based on what we're talking about, not the rock. In other words, if I'm an anthropologist, I don't go and show me everything that's granite. I say, show me everything that has cultural significance. That's a different way of describing it. It comes from the community. And if I'm a geologist or I'm doing this on my own, my personal images, my point is by focusing on these conversations, we can begin to organize, track, find document-like objects, and these new digital, disparate, changing worlds. But not all people are online. This idea that the online is going to replace it because everything's digital, that's not true. Now, in the States, we use this phrase, digital divide. That the idea is that there are people who can get online and participate in this electronic world and people who can't. you're probably there. Many countries, we're still there in many of our lower income areas, frankly, in many of our rural areas. But it's not just one. See, we made a mistake. When we first began talking about digital divide, we thought there was just one. And we defined it this way, access. That people who are too poor or too remote didn't have access to technology, so we gave them a computer, we gave them internet access, we gave them a phone line. And we said, congratulations. But it wasn't enough. But it is enough if we talk about access, not just to materials and stuff and things like that. I want you to think about access to conversations and each other as well as artifacts. We had that conversation before. But once again, it's not enough. If you simply say, here it is, here's your computer, here's your website, here's the front door, it's not enough. There are more than one digital divide. The next one is around training and knowledge. So in the United States, we had in our primary and secondary education, we had teachers that we gave computers and said, teach better. Here's a computer, go online, get information online. But it wasn't enough because they looked at this thing and said, I don't know how to use it. I don't know what this smart board is or what this F key is. And so what we had to do is we had to give them the second type of digital divide remedy, and that was knowledge and training. That we provide people that, yes, you can get to the book, you can get to the conversation, you can get to the website, you can get to the meeting, but in order to make sense of it all, you need to know the following. You need to know the language we're using. You need to know the history of what's happening. You need to know the cultural norms. You need to know technology. And I put in there the idea of learning by doing because someone could take this and say, oh, does that mean that librarians have to be experts in every potential conversation that's going on? That as a public librarian, I have to know everything about the tax code and the school system and physics and all of this? No. Because we know that people learn best by doing. That sometimes we provide a learning environment and they teach us how it's going. So we can get to a conversation. We can get to an artifact. We can get to a material. We have the training. We know what to do when we get there. But the next question, the next divide is, do we feel safe once we're there? Now, safety can have physical aspects as well as intellectual aspects. The idea that, for example, you can go online and search for anything. You have access to online databases in the web. Well, you know how to use it. Go look wherever you want. By the way, we're going to be writing down every website you've been to, and we're going to report it to someone. People suddenly get this freezing effect where once they feel like they're under surveillance, they suddenly don't spend all the time looking in the radical and crazy sections. So what do libraries do? We talk about privacy. We talk about providing a physical space where people can come in and learn, where they're not going to be harassed, where it's safe, where it's comfortable, but also intellectually safe so that when you go online, when you do these materials, when you think about things, we're not sitting watching. We talk about intellectual freedom. That is a matter of providing safety. But even that's not enough. When you get to a conversation, you know what conversation's going on, how to participate, and you feel safe to do it, do you want to? And so the last thing we have to talk about is motivation. How do we as libraries deal with motivation? The fact that people either want to or don't want to learn. First of all, everyone learns. It's intrinsically into your brain. It just may not be them learning what you want them to learn. And so we've learned a lot about intrinsic motivation. Much of librarianship is based on the concept of intrinsic motivation, that people will come to us when they need us. That we'll just wait for people to be understanding and come in, and then they'll use us. And so we sort of don't even think about it that much, about what drives people to do this. Yet if we don't understand what reward they're seeking, personal satisfaction, a good grade on the paper, a pay raise, better policy, what have you, if we don't understand that motivation, how can we truly answer their questions? Second, we need to understand about extrinsic motivation. If you're in a primary or secondary library, the reason they may be coming to you is because their teacher made them do it. That's extrinsic. The reward comes not from the individual, but from someone outside of it. And we have to think about, well, how do we turn it into an intrinsic motivation? Or how do we set up other extrinsic motivation? When a professor goes for tenure at a college, how do we knock on the door and say, we're going to help you do your tenure package? And we're going to do it so that it's guaranteed to be accurate and right and all these other things, and you've got to use the librarian to ensure quality of the tenure process. That's an extrinsic motivation. But we have to be careful. There's a huge discussion around gamification, about the way that we can try and incent people to learn more is by giving them badges and points and turning everything into a game. Scott Nicholson, my colleague, has done studies into this, and what he finds is quickly, if you replace an intrinsic motivation with an extrinsic motivation, you will kill motivation altogether. In other words, if I want to learn and I start using a piece of software, intrinsically motivated, and that software starts saying, ooh, you got 10 points, ooh, 20 points, 30 points, I soon am so busy trying to get more points that I forget what I was trying to learn. So we as librarians have to balance these internal and external forms of motivation. So here's my bottom line. Here's the conclusion. Why should we change our idea of libraries from organizers, collectors, and disseminators of stuff and information to this new idea of libraries as learning spaces and librarians as facilitators of knowledge and conversation? Why should we make that shift? Why should we change from focusing on what we do to why we do it? Why should we make a difference in libraries? Why shouldn't we just look at these challenges and throw our hands up and say, you know, the time of libraries has come and gone. Why should we fight for libraries? And we should fight for libraries. Why should we look at these challenges? This is the glass. I don't know if you have this saying, but the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. When you look at a glass, is this glass half full? Meaning, yay, I've got a half a glass? Or is it half empty, which means, oh, I only have half a glass? When you look at those challenges and you work in the assumption of you're in the stuff business and the stuff business is in trouble, every challenge becomes another hassle, another thing that's going to put us out of business, and you turn very pessimistic. You sort of wait for retirement. But if, on the other hand, you take Nietzsche's advice in talking about things that don't kill you make you stronger, and you look at these challenges as opportunities for innovation, where libraries can take what's happening. People going online is great. People being able to search for information and finding, that's great. People could publish from anywhere. That's fantastic. And if you take a learning perspective and talk about the importance of librarians, they can close the library and we'll have more jobs than ever because people are going to need to learn more than ever, challenged to learn in new ways. Fundamentally, why we do, whatever it is we do, has to be about learning, has to be about getting people in a better place through knowledge. And that means conversations, that means people, that means thoughts. That's fundamental. That is why we do what we do and why we need that forever and ever. Your role is vitally important. You have to take the opportunity today to innovate, change thinking, grab that community, understand that community, work with that community, talk with that community, and turn your back on the collection. Don't throw it away. It's not unimportant. It's not unimportant. But you can lead by paying attention to the community, and if you need the collection, then you can turn around and get it. But don't start with the collection and wonder if anyone needs it. A great librarian is someone who understands their community is the collection. That expertise, that knowledge, that question, that aspiration, those dreams, how people want to make a better world, that's your collection. That's what needs to be organized and collected and provided access to and disseminated. That's the cool stuff. And it may result in a book or a video, and you might grab those and create it for the next person who needs inspiration, but the primary function is learning, not warehousing. Libraries are crucial and essential. We need to move from this idea that we have a collection that we loan out to we are fundamental facilitators of people learning and getting better and making a better tomorrow. That's why we need libraries. That's why libraries are fundamental, and that's why your job will never be replaced by a search engine. Thank you very much for your time. I welcome your questions online. You can find the screencast and slides from this on my website, as well as contact information so that we can continue the conversation. Thanks again.